And have to do a little searching to find something that hasn't been said about the book. I've read an enormous amount of clippings. People have sent me material. So
it has caused some excitement.
Really? Did it surprise you, all of the consternation this diary has produced?
Yes, it did. I figured it was going to be a controversial book because H.L. Mencken never wrote a book that wasn't. But I was totally unprepared for the firestorm that erupted.
And yet, you've been a lifelong fan of Mencken's. You've written a previous book about Mencken, so it shouldn't have come as a complete surprise.
The material in the diary did not come as a complete surprise to me, although there were things in it that surprised me. What surprised me was the tremendous reaction to it on the part of reviewers and critics. And, of course, most of this centered around the charges of anti-Semitism, racism, pro-Germanism during World War II, and the unkind things that he said about people who were supposed to be his friends.
The unkind things, yes, but it wasn't that bad. I have a feeling that in reading all of the material that some of the critics and writers have been saying about this book, that they were absolutely shocked. I wasn't particularly shocked, and I don't think after reading the diary that you edited, it was all that bad. It seemed to me that he was saying something in the casual way that people did in the 40s and 30s. You know, those Jews down the block, you know,
yes,
they,
exactly.
You know, that sort of thing, without really thinking.
Yes, I think this has to be borne in mind, particularly in dealing with the charges of anti-Semitism. As you probably know, there was, at that time, in the 30s and 40s, let's say a quiet, covert anti-Semitism. I know in my own Baltimore, in Mencken's Baltimore, there were neighborhoods that were restricted, which meant that Jews could not move into those neighborhoods. There were clubs that Jews could not belong to. There were swimming pools that Jews could not go in. And similar things. Undoubtedly, you know, this must be classified as anti-Semitism, but it was not the kind of insane thing that developed in Nazi Germany during the 30s. This was the anti-Semitism that I think Mencken absorbed all unconsciously throughout his life. It became a part of him, and it is reflected in many an entry in the diary. That's regrettable, and you know I don't think there's an excuse for it. I would not try to defend him. All I can say, you know, I offer this as an explanation rather than as a defense. He absorbed it all unconsciously; it became a part of him, and you would have thought that he, who rose above so many of the common prejudices and stereotypes of his day, would have risen above this one too. But he didn't.
However, it should be noted that this was a private, personal diary that had not been seen by anybody until, 6 years ago, I think?
1981, yes.
So he didn't write this for public consumption. His feelings, his fears, his frustrations, his love, his sadness were manifested in this private document.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that true? So it's not as though he, as a writer and a journalist, ever expressed this sort of racism or anti-Semitism?
There were suspicions of it from his published writings.
Suspicions?
Yes.
What does that mean? I mean, if somebody writes something, it's there in black and white.
There are occasional remarks in his published writings about Jewish people. One of the stories that appeared in the Baltimore Evening Sun after the publication of the diary began with three attitudes of people. And the first one was the Jewish community. Their attitude was, so what else is new?
And yet, in reading the diary, I noticed that his worst and most scathing criticism was of the people who were WASP, the Appalachian people, whites, who came into Baltimore to work in the defense plant.
That's right, yes.
I mean, that was awful. And he compares... In fact, he compares the blacks that he knew favorably as superiors
to these
whites, these white Anglo-Saxons. Well, let's go back a little bit. First of all, Many people, young people today, don't know Mencken. I was shocked, for example, to find out, I was hosting a gathering of journalism students from Ohio University, which is my alma mater, and they were en route to London and Paris every December. They take this trip and they go to the news capitals and they visit the networks and the Reuters and places like that. And with them was a professor of journalism who teaches journalism history, and I was shocked to find out that in his history of journalism course, he did not teach H.L. Mencken. He did not teach Ambrose Bierce. And Mencken, of course, was the intellectual heir in many respects of Ambrose Bierce. And I was very surprised because Mencken, certainly in the first portion of this century, was one of the most, if not the most, influential journalists. So for the benefit of students who are going to journalism school today and young people, who was H.L. Mencken?
He was, as you said, probably the most powerful and influential literary critic in the first half of this century. I don't think it would be going too far to say that he literally changed the whole course of American literature. He became a book editor of the old Smartset magazine in the year 1908, and later he co-edited it with his friend George G. Nathan. Mencken hammered away mercilessly at the so-called genteel tradition, which had characterized American literature in the latter part of the 19th and the early part of the 20th century. To him, it represented a completely false set of values. And while he was attacking this, he was also encouraging and beating the drum for a whole new generation of writers, men like Theodore Dreiser, Sinclair Lewis, Sherwood Anderson, Scott Fitzgerald, and so on, who were bringing a completely new tone and treatment to American literature. These men would have been important in their own right if they had never known H.L. Mencken. But as editor of the Smartset and later of the American Mercury, he was able to really publicize their work, to encourage them, and to make them better known to a much larger audience. That was his influence as a literary critic. As a journalist, he covered all the national political conventions from about 1920 to 1948. He wrote a column for his own paper, the Baltimore Evening Sun, every Monday for 18 years. While editing the American Mercury, he wrote hundreds of editorials and articles on political and social subjects. He attacked practically every politician who was around at the time. He said that a good politician is as unthinkable as an honest burglar. And he dismissed all of them as frauds, quacks, and charlatans. So, it was the sheer force of his style, and perhaps I should have mentioned the style earlier, because whether he's writing about literature or about politics or whatever, he has a style that is utterly unique in American literature. Powerful and pungent, filled with the most incredible similes and metaphors, and a vocabulary that must be one of the largest in the English language.
And he was an autodidact, I think, his education with Baltimore Poly.
That's right, which is a trade high school.
His most famous newspaper story took place, I believe, I mean, I'm not a historian as you are with regard to Mencken, but I believe it took place in a little town in Tennessee. Can you tell me about that?
Dayton, Tennessee, the famous Scopes Monkey Trial. There was a law on the books of the state of Tennessee forbidding the teaching of the Darwinian theory of evolution to high school students. A young teacher named John Thomas Scopes decided to test this law and deliberately taught the Darwinian theory of evolution in one of his classes. He was arrested on charges of breaking the laws of the state of Tennessee. The case became an enormous cause célèbre of the time. William Jennings Bryan, who had been three times Secretary of State, was on the prosecution side. Clarence Darrow, the most celebrated trial lawyer of the day, and a number of other important lawyers, went to Scopes' defense. As I say, the case attracted national attention. Mencken covered it for his paper, The Baltimore Evening Sun. And the stories that he wrote about it are classics of journalism, which, as I'm sure you know, is not a field that normally produces enduring classics. His coverage of that trial can still be read today with the utmost enjoyment.
By the way, have his dispatches, the monkey trial and the monkey trial, ever been gathered in book form?
No, they have not. Mencken included some of them in an anthology of his writings.
Uh-huh. Which one was that, do you recall?
A Mencken Krestomathy, it's called.
Oh, yes, I have that.
A collection of his out-of-print writings, which he did in 1948. But the complete coverage of the trial has never been published anymore.
Next book to edit?
I'll leave the job for somebody else.
Well, reverberations of that case continue, and they're still fighting it.
That's right. It's still going on today, incredible as it may seem.
What was this, the Hatrack case? What was that about?
Hatrack was a story that appeared in the American Mercury the following year, 1926. It was a short story about a prostitute in a small town who was called Hatrack because of her figure. It's been years since I read the story, but as I remember, she took her Catholic customers to the Protestant cemetery and her Protestant customers to the Catholic cemetery.
That was ecumenical.
It was indeed, yes, in a time before ecumenism was very well known. Anyhow, there was an organization in Boston called the Watch and Ward Society, which made it a point to pounce upon any book, any magazine, any paper which, in its opinion, could be deemed obscene or offensive. This organization passed out, incidentally, the organization as such had no legal standing. It was not a part of the law of the city of Boston. But its influence was so powerful that if it declared a certain book or paper to be obscene, bookstores and newsstands simply would be afraid to handle it. It was headed by a man named Chase, and Chase sent word around to all the bookstores and newsstands that this issue of the American Mercury was offensive because of the Hatrack story in it and was not to be sold. When Mencken heard of this, he went up to Boston, sold a copy of the magazine to Chase on Boston Common, and was arrested for selling an obscene magazine. The next morning, in court, the judge threw the case out. He had read the story, determined that it was not obscene. There were a number of developments following that. The issue was barred from the mails, which was a rather moot point since it had already been mailed out anyway. Mencken and his publisher, Alfred Knopf, engaged in litigation with the Post Office Department over this. Technically, they lost, but, you know, over the long run, they really won because it's been a long time since a book has been barred from the mails for being obscene.
And the judge in Boston, as I recall, throughout the case, after hearing testimony in quiet voices before the bar, so as not to offend the court.
Yes, that's right.
In addition to his being a journalist and being a literary critic, he was also a man known for his interest in language. Tell me about that.
His greatest and most enduring work is The American Language, which is a study of the English language as it developed and changed in the United States. He published the first edition of it in 1919, a second edition in 1921, a third edition in 1923, and a completely rewritten fourth edition, which is, for all practical purposes, a new book, in 1936. And then he brought out two supplements to the fourth edition in 1945 and 1948. Those four editions and two supplements total something like 3,800 pages, which in itself would almost have constituted the life work of any other man. But it was really only one aspect of his activities. But, you know, he traced with amazing scholarship the development of English from the time of the first colonists arrived here down to his own time, and pointed out how the English spoken by Americans and the English spoken by the English are so different that, as he said, they're almost mutually unintelligible.
Which, of course, was the thrust of my own book about Megan.
Yeah, yes, I recall.
Well, at some point during this, all these heavy journalistic responsibilities, he started a diary, and he started it rather late. When did this happen?
He began the diary in 1930, when he was 50 years old, and kept it until 1948, just a few days before he was felled by a massive stroke.
But apparently he was worried about some of the things he said in his diary, so he didn't want anybody to see it, knowing that at some point he would die, right? What were the circumstances of that?
He left the diary, along with most of his other papers, to the Enoch Bradfrey Library in Baltimore. The diary was given to them with the stipulation that it could not be opened until 25 years after his death. Now, I think the reason for that was that he assumed that everybody mentioned in it would be dead by that time. As it turned out, he was wrong. A number of people mentioned in it were still living when it was opened in 1981, and even today, 9 years later, some still are. There's a question about whether he intended it to be published at all. It was given to the library in five sealed wooden boxes, and each of those boxes contained a label saying, first of all, that it could not be opened until 25 years after his death, and then it was to be made accessible only to serious scholars engaged in research, which gives one the impression that he did not intend it for publication. However, in his will, he stipulated that among his unpublished papers, if there was anything among them which, in the judgment of his literary executors, was worth publishing, they should exercise that judgment and publish it. And the diary was certainly worth publishing.
Now, who are the literary executors?
The Enoch Bradfrey Library.
So they are in effect the estate of the...
Yes, they are the estate of H.L. Mencken.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago that you thought his most enduring work was the American language, but there are some people who believe the trilogy of memoirs, the Days series, may be the work that will live long after Mencken. And interestingly, there are still more memoirs that he wrote that are yet to be read. Isn't that true?
That's right. There are seven boxes still in the Pratt Library vault. Four boxes called My Life as Author and Editor, and three boxes called 35 Years of Newspaper Work. They can't be opened until the 35th anniversary of his death, which will be January the 29th, 1991, just a little over a year off. Now, what's in those is anybody's guess. He discusses them here and there in the diary, and obviously they run to thousands of pages.
Are you going to tackle those?
No, I have no plans. I will be very curious and interested in reading them. You know, I'm not even sure that they will be publishable as books.
I would assume that they're drafts or they're rough.
Yes.
Although he was such an elegant writer that... I mean, I don't know how much editing you did to his diary, but it reads so well.
Oh, I edited none of that. Yeah, here and there he might have made a typing error or left a word out or something like that, and since it was obvious what the word was supposed to be, I inserted it in brackets. But, you know, I did no editing on his writing at all.
Then there's a good chance that much of those memoirs in the future will be published.
It's possible, yes.
What's going to happen? Will there be a big ceremony? They're going to crack open?
I suppose the ceremony will be the same as when they opened the diary and the four boxes called Letters and Documents Relating to the Baltimore Sun Papers. You know, one of the library's maintenance men came in with a saw, as I recall, and, you know, sawed away at these boxes and pulled them open. And there the materials were in bound in handsome Morocco covers.
Did Minkin himself bind his diaries?
No, and I don't think he did the actual binding.
Who did the binding of the diaries?
I don't know.
But how, when he wrote the diaries, he wrote them in as individual sheets of paper. It wasn't as though he wrote by hand, because you mentioned he dictated some of the diaries to Mrs. Lorfay.
When I say they were bound, they were in Morocco boxes.
Oh, boxes.
The kind are called Solander boxes, which are made to look like a book, and you know, you pull. You pull the inside away, and you know the sheets are in there.
Yeah, those are these acid-free containers for mostly rare manuscripts and books and things. But his diary, were they individual sheets of paper?
Yes.
But each sheet was numbered and dated?
Yes. When I say each sheet was numbered, if an entry ran to more than one page, and many did, he numbered the pages of that entry, but there is no continuous pagination of the diary from beginning to end.
Boy, I wonder, he would have made great use of a computer, wouldn't he?
Oh, he would have
to sit at a Macintosh or something.
I'm sure he would have.
If he had, so much he has written by hand, I mean, if he could really grind out the stuff with a computer, do without a secretary even. Hate to go that far. Well, now, some other reviewer, I hate to say scholars, because I don't think the answer is in yet, but some of the people who reviewed the diary of H.L. Mencken have said, well, this means the end of his reputation, it suffered mortally, his influence in the future will be nil, but in reading the diary of H.L. Mencken, I'm not so sure that it was all as bad as we mentioned as we started that it was trumped up to be. So I have a feeling that this is all going to die down, and he's probably going to emerge unscathed. Now, you, as the author of Mencken, I think it was called Mencken and His Thought,
Study of His Thought.
What is your estimation of Mencken's future influence?
I agree with you that his reputation is not going to be permanently damaged or tarnished. Let me say this. The Pratt Library publishes a magazine called Menckeniana, a quarterly journal of Mencken studies, of which I have the honor to be editor. Not one person has canceled a subscription. There is a Mencken Society numbering about 600 or 700 members nationwide and also in some foreign countries, and not one person has resigned from the society in protest. I don't think there is going to be any serious loss of his reputation. Of course, future biographers and scholars are going to have to take this into consideration in their writings and, you know, weigh it, but I don't think that it is going to do any permanent damage.
I remember interviewing a man whose name escapes me, but he wrote a definitive biography of Thornton Wilder. I don't know if you read that biography. But I
think I have seen it, but I can't recall the name of the author either.
Check my files. Now, he's an older man who, in his youth, approximately 1946 or 47, went out to dinner with Mencken, and they went to, I believe, the Shell House restaurant in Baltimore. And Mencken, he was seated next to Mencken. And the waiters were black at the Shell House, or at least one was black. And this man, and I wish I could remember his name, this was after I'd already sent my story into St. Martin's Press to be published. Otherwise, I might have used it, but then again, this was what he said. At any rate, he said, after they were served and the waiter walked away, Mencken said in a very loud voice that carried, he said, around the restaurant, he said, one thing you can say about niggers today, they're a lot cleaner than they used to be. And he told me, we were seated here, he was seated here right where you were, this was some years ago, a couple years ago. And I said, gosh, that doesn't sound like anything I've read, because I'd read your book, and it doesn't sound like something Minkin would say. And yet, at the same time, I thought in the back of my mind, well, it is possible. So I was kind of surprised, but that never got into my book. And in reading the diary, now I'm not surprised at all.
It was a word that was used at that time.
It still is.
Yeah, but not as much.
No, absolutely not.
But, you know, black people were niggers, Jews were kikes, Italians were wops and dagos, Polish people were Polaks. These are terms that have almost disappeared from our vocabulary, thank heaven. But they were common enough in that day, and well, I agree with you, it is hard to imagine Mencken saying something like that, but...
But he did.
But he did, yes.
Well, what has this done to the city of Baltimore, the home of Mencken, the sage of Crabdad on the on the flats?
The reaction has been incredible. Both the Morning and Evening Sun have run long stories, sensationalizing him as much as possible. The Evening Sun, which was his own paper, ran an editorial, no less, comparing the diary to Richard Nixon's tapes, and ended by calling him a conceited bigot. The Morning Sun, which is, of course, a completely separate paper, did provide some calming influence with an editorial that dismissed most of the sensational charges and said the people who are in the habit of dishing it out have to learn to be able to take it. The Evening Sun invited its readers to write letters to the editor on their opinion of Mencken after reading the diary, and about a dozen people did, I suppose.
There was kind of a mixed reaction.
Yeah, it was mixed, I would say, half and half. But letters to the editor of both the Morning and Evening papers are continuing to appear, mostly anti-Mencken.
How did it happen? There must have been some competition for the honor of editing this diary. How did you win this honor?
I don't know. there was competition, of course. My understanding is that there were about a dozen applicants for the job. I had published a book on Mencken, as you mentioned. I'm the editor of the Pratt Libraries magazine, Menckeniana. I was retired by that time and could give it my full time. And I lived in Baltimore, so that no travel was required. I suppose that all of these things had something to do with the selection of me as the editor.
Well, you were the right man for the right job. And who knows, the memoirs, the unpublished ones, may fall into your lap once again.
I'll try to avoid it.
I know. I think this has probably been a remarkable experience?
Yes, it has. It has indeed. As I said, I was totally unprepared for it.
Well, I bet you're glad you did it, though. Charles Fetcher, it's an enlightening book, The Diary of H.L. Mencken. Thank you very, very much.
I was happy to be here.